How are you?
Doing well, thank you so much.
So, I have to hear first and foremost, how was the world premiere of The Militia on Wednesday night?
Gosh, it was a total blast. Getting to premiere at the Chinese Theater was a dream of mine. I kind of manifested it in a way. When in 2017, I was like, I was at the theater, and I was like, I have to screen here someday, somehow. I don't know how, but I hope that it happens. And then it did, and I totally freaked out. It was great.
How was the crowd? Did you have a large turnout for the screening?
Yeah, there were a bunch of people there. I feel like the whole theater was like packed for like all sorts of screenings. You know what I mean? In the main hall, there were probably it had to have been like 500 people all stacked in there to see like all sorts of different films. Yeah, we did a good Q&A afterwards and everything. It was just a really good time.
So, how many tickets did you sell for this one? How full was your theater specifically for you?
Oh, my specific theater? I'm not exactly sure.
Well, you should probably find that out at some point.
I should find that out. Yeah, I'll give them a call and I'll see what the totals were. But I don't really know.
I think Scott may know. It's a great place for a premiere. It's a good festival for a world premiere. So you lucked out on all counts, Dylan.
Well, yeah, it was totally insane. I think one of the things that I really like about the festival, even when we were applying, is that it's a festival that you have to get in on by merit. You can't really grease the wheels to get your way in, even if you have a big star. That's not what it's about. So when you get chosen, it's like, oh yeah, they like your film. That's it, hands down. And that's really cool. I think that puts a lot of weight behind it.
So, was anybody from the cast there with you?
We had Sam Williamson, the lead actor, was there with us, and then the cinematographer Steve McKisson came as well, and then actually a couple of extras showed up, which was phenomenal. They were just really excited about the premieres, and they were like, "Can we come too?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely, if you want to come." So even the, there are no small roles, right? Like, it was great to have a good crew there.
You brought up a very important part. You mentioned an important part of this film, and that's Sam. Talk about a breakout performance and discovery by you, Sam Williamson. Wow.
Yeah, what'd you think?
Talk about intensity and focus. He totally embodied what we have seen and heard over the years in media, mainstream news, the fringe right and lefts, totally embodied somebody who has no idea of the world and is so laser focused on his one ideology that there is nothing else. And he sold that. Had I been his mother, I would have beat the crap out of him. But, I digress since she handed him grenades. But wow, he became Daniel Pierce. And
No,
that's
it was
scary.
unbelievable.
That's
It was
scary.
unbelievable. At the end of the screening, his father came up to me with tears in his eyes. The man was crying. And he was like, "The transformation that you have put my son through was unbelievable. I just didn't, he isn't like that. Sam isn't that person." And to see him go that far for the character, I mean, you sold it. I couldn't believe that the character did that, and it was just a totally different person. And I was touched. I mean, I was really left speechless. I was just like, "Well, thank you so much." I mean, it was Sam. Sam's the one who got there, and you know, we worked together really, really well, which was fantastic. I mean, it was amazing to like get to talk with him and kind of like help him mold his character, because it was a whole new thing for him. You know, he'd never been on screen before. He'd done plenty of theater and plenty of like stage work, but you know, we got to sit down and talk about like the nuance of character and like come up with a backstory for his character and talk about like getting into what, you know, what the real granular pieces of it was. It was going to be on screen. It's just like, there's no one you have to talk to, you know, on the far end. There's no stage, you know, everyone, all the conversation is right here. It's just the air between us. Mm-hmm. And it was just something special to watch him work.
So I want to ask you, Dylan, with that in mind and the extremes that Sam went to, and we've seen this happen with other actors who have truly embodied a character and gone that extra mile, and then they can't come out of that character and have trouble in their lives because of it. Was there ever a point in this production, because it's his first screen role, that you had to say to him, pull back a little? Because he goes so far in here that I'm just curious if you ever had to rein him back a little bit.
I didn't have to rein him back. There was no like moment where he wasn't out of control, but we had conversations about putting the mask on and taking the mask off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was like, you know, it was one of these things where it's like, this is not the role to learn how to, you know, character act. You know what I mean? It was like this is the role. You know, we put the mask on, and then after set we would decompress.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, and you know, his friends were there on set a lot, and they're also in the film as well. Elliot Daggett, Solomon Puckett, they play Tyler and Sammy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think their camaraderie is so
strong
in the
film.
Yeah, because they're actual friends. You know, it was amazing to find a group like that that had the chops and could make it happen. But then afterwards, they could readjust back to themselves. You know,
mm-hmm.
we would decompress every day after set and be like, all right, now, you know, that character's done. Back to being ourselves. Like, everybody relax. And I think they had that flexibility, and they could kind of open up a little more because they trusted each other. You know, that was another big part too. I think they could go to vulnerable places because they all knew each other,
mm-hmm.
and that helped even more. So that was a big bonus.
Well, with this film, I'm glad to hear that you had guys, you cast guys that are actually friends, because it works to your advantage in this setting. Because the teens, the people here in this film, the adults have an outside context, but the teens, the kids, have no outside context. All they know is this one contained world. So you really feel the shared experiences of the boys, the Wild Bunch, as they're coining themselves. They have no outside influences. So all they know is each other. So to have that dynamic play out works really, really well and to your advantage with this story.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, you know, I remember we were talking about it when we were discussing kind of the Wild Bunch before. I was talking it with my writing partner, and part of it we were saying is like, you know, a big part of it is the way you're raised. And I mean, a huge, massive part of it is, and the point of the film is that it's the way you're raised and the way you're taught. But then we were talking about the fact that this ideology and this kind of like extreme stuff can really spread due to like peer pressure and identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
To where it's like, well, maybe you're not so totally sold, but when every single person that you know is doing that, or is saying, well, you know, well, what else are you going to do? Are you going to go to the other side? Well, how can you say no? you know, you just feel pressured because your entire family and friends have done it. And we try to show that with the Wild Bunch at certain points, mm-hmm. you know, where there are some lines in the sand that are drawn. But that peer pressure, you know, it's strong. You know, you don't want to let your buddies down, even when ideas are terrible ideas.
Yeah.
And I remember being young and, you know, hanging out with my buddies and just feeling that peer pressure to do whatever, right? I mean, I think everybody can kind of relate to that at some point. So we wanted to really kind of show that to the extreme.
Yeah, you have that moment in the film where people, friends are defying Daniel. It's like, no, man, no, we're not going to do it. You got harebrained ideas. This is where the voice in the back of your head, you'd hear your mother saying, just because your friends jump off a bridge doesn't mean you have to do it too. So you give us these two sides of the coin here. And like you said, you do draw lines in the sand. And you leave it up to the audience to figure out what those lines are. Should they be crossed? Should they not be crossed? You do not get preachy with this story, Dylan. And I think that's really important because this is such a hot button topic.
Yeah.
On both sides of the fence, the far left, the far right, and everybody in between. Because we have seen what happens with militia in the United States. And
yeah.
So much of it has not been good at all. Especially when we get into bombings of buildings and things like that. Oklahoma City bombing. You shot this in Kansas City, Missouri. So that's like right in the heart of where some of the most heinous militia attacks have happened.
Yeah, the Oklahoma City bombing is, you know, just down the, just a, you know, one state away. There was a local group that, there was like a daylight shooting, which is, this has been years ago. There's like a daylight shooting that happened and no one was ever arrested for it. It's pretty wild. And then of course, you know, you can see it on the national scale, but you can also see it in that homegrown scale
yep.
as well. I think like you said, in trying not to preach, one of the most important things that I felt that came out of the film was after we had done the premiere, one of the ACs, this is a cameraman that worked on the film.
Mm-hmm.
He came up to me and he goes, dude, I thought it was going to be good and we were making it, but that, you know, that was way better than I had even imagined. But I got to ask you a question. I got to ask, are we rooting for the bad guys? And I looked him dead in the eye and I said, who are you rooting for?
It's who are the bad guys. It's open to your interpretation.
Well, and I think that's the discussion I want people to have, is that I wanted it to be a film where the extreme right could come, the extreme left could come. They could watch it and be like, I love that film. And then be like, why? Why do you like that film? You know, and then discuss it. And be like, well, I feel like these things should exist. And be like, I feel like these things shouldn't exist. I certainly don't condone the actions of Daniel at all. And I think that there are people within the film that align with Daniel that also see that he crosses a line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of the discussion to have, right? It's like, where does constitutionalism meet extremism? You know, like, where does patriotism turn a nasty corner? And that's where that's what we don't want to do, right? There's a line. There's a line. And, like, you can't cross it.
Well, and this is where your character of Sheriff Webb and Luke Strata-McClure does an amazing job as Webb.
Yeah.
That is, he is the voice of reason, shall we say.
Yeah.
Depending on what side of the fence you're on. Well, no matter what side of the fence you're on, he's giving a counterpoint to the adult militia, to the Wild Bunch, and particularly trying to reach Daniel. He is so calm. He never gets enraged. He even berates his own deputy at his conduct. So you do a wonderful job with the crafting of Webb and then Luke's performance on top of it. That is really a cornerstone here. And then, of course, with Lee, the character of Lee and Michael Broderick's performance, he may be a prominent member of the militia proper, but even he has a line. He has a line in the sand, and you hear him address that with his son, with Daniel, in the third act about having a line in the sand. We have the militia leader, Nathan, who has a couple lines in the sand. And this is really interesting to see unfold, because even within each person, they have a moral compass in there somewhere.
Right. And that's really what I was trying to reach is that, like, you know, these people, you know, are, it's like, how do you get here? Right. You know, it's like, they're not aliens, you know, like even when you take horrible actions, you have to pay for your actions. And I think that, you know, is one of the huge takeaways, you know, is like without ruining the film, without spoiling too much, you know, like, I think that, you know, Daniel wants, he like needs to get everything that he wants, but in doing so, he gives up everything to get what he wants. And like, that's the price that he pays. And yeah, with Webb, especially, you know, he's kind of the straight man, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, he's the voice of reason. I agree. And you know, that's a lot of the, you know, one of the secondary themes, you know, the main theme that we were going for, kind of the theme stated, is that extremism breeds extremism, especially when you're in a vacuum. If you don't know any better and everyone's telling you this, then of course you're going to believe this extreme idea because you have no one else to teach you. And then you have Webb, who is this voice of reason, this outside line, and he's like trying his hardest to break through and be like, there's another way. There's another view here. And it's kind of the death of reason with Webb, you know, because Daniel has that choice of like, I could see someone else's side, you know? I could take this olive branch that this person is off me, and he doesn't take it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the case in so many cases. There are two sides to every coin.
We need more olive branches. I think that's my big stance, is more olive branches. More olive branches all around.
But when the olive branch is put out there, somebody has to take it.
Correct.
That's the other point. That's the other element, the other tine in that fork. Now, I'm really curious about your logistics for shooting this, for the production itself. Number one, your location is beautiful. I love Steven's cinematography. There's nothing fancy. However, it's all outdoors. You're using natural light, which cuts down on your budgeting concerns for light packages.
Sure.
So logistically, because of the area, and I see hills and I see woods and forested places and dirt roads, how challenging was this from a logistic standpoint? And plus, you don't have a small cast. You got a lot of people you're working with too.
We had a lot of extras. Yeah, there was a lot of extra work on set too. If you talk to my sound guy, who's one of my best buddies, Ross, he did a phenomenal job too. He did the on-set recording and the mix as well. But he came to me one day and he said, "Dylan, your film was a logistical nightmare." And I was like, "Well, it says woods in the script. It said exterior woods." And he's like, "Where did you think that we were gonna, you know, and he's like, I know it says exterior woods, but I didn't know we were gonna be hiking through the woods." And it's like, well, unless you have a sound stage or you can build the woods inside, we're hiking in the woods, buddy. So no, we shot on this 26-acre plot of land, and it has fields and hills and woods and forest. And you turn the camera, 20 degrees, and you're in a different location. You turn the camera, 20 degrees, you're in another location. So we had kind of a home base, but we did have to kind of like wander around the property a lot, and like carrying, and like you're totally right about the light packaging. Like Steve is doing a great job of shaping natural light. So it was tons of, a lot of bounce, a lot of fill. So we were still carrying like C-stands and like grip equipment around through the woods, which got like pretty tricky, especially during kind of like the opening scene, the opening action sequence. Yeah, that was like we shot that on like a 100-degree day, and like the sweat that's pouring down their faces is just actual sweat because everyone was dying. And but yeah, we're in the woods, we're in the trees. Yeah, there was a lot of hiking to get around, but like the crew was fantastic, and everyone really put up a good put on a good face for everything. I think the schedule, like we shot it in 30 days. And even though that is pretty short, for like a feature length film, I mean, a lot of indies, as you probably know, shoot in, sometimes 15 or 20 days,
Lately, it's
so.
been a lot less than that, Dylan. A lot of the indies now they're limited. I just interviewed a director the other day. He had 6 days. That was it.
Oh my goodness. 6 days. My good. Yeah, we couldn't have done it. We couldn't have done it with that amount of time, especially with like the layout. So, I think we budgeted our time really well. But then on top of it, kind of like the church location, the shooting ranges, there are two of them, in the film. They're local Kansas City businesses, and when we went to them and took the script to them and talked to them, they didn't really know anything about films. So they were like, yeah, well, we don't mind the script. Like, how does it work? Explain it to us. And we talked to them, and we're just like, this is, this is how we set up, and we'd use it for a couple days. So, it was one evening for the interior place. They're like, well, as long as you film after we're closed, we're happy to let you come in and film there. And just working with kind of like local independent businesses, made it so much easier. Not to say that like filming in a studio isn't great, but you pay for it. Whereas shooting on location everywhere, these locations were, really just kind of like, oh, cool. Like you've never had a film come here before. That'd be exciting. So it was a lot of logistics. It was a lot of travel. I mean, we had a lot of set moves. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of locations. There's a lot of different locations, but that core group on that land, I think, was probably like the toughest for everyone to kind of like move set around through the forest and through the woods. But I think it adds to like the life of it. You look out across like the woods and the plains and the fields, and it is real. It's not a painted picture or anything. It's not CG. You're just like, oh, this looks beautiful.
Yeah, it's not a contained little 20 by 20 set. So now I'm curious though, for poor Steven, what kind of camera rig was he using? And were you guys shooting on sticks, on Steadicam, on handheld? Are you laying dolly track down through the woods? What was this like for poor Steven?
Great question. No, we talked to, I talked to Steve about it and was like, how are we going to do this? And, we spent the entire month of April doing, all of the photo boards for the film. So we shot every frame. We went to all of the locations. We locked the locations first. So this is a little bit out of order than I think usual films do it, but I like to work this way when I can. We got lucky and we could. We locked our locations first, and then we spent all of April going to every single location and doing photo boards for every single scene, for every single shot. So So we shot the film in photo in its entirety in April. Mm-hmm. And, like, got every single one of our shots. And then we sat down and we talked about it, and we were like, okay, do we want to add moves here? Exactly what you're talking about. Like, how do we want the camera to move? How do we want, you know, what do we want it to feel like? What do we want it to look like? And Steve kind of he kept on talking. He's like, I feel like this is the end of this kid's childhood. I really want it to feel like it's forever sunset, because it's just the twilight of his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so we filmed a lot during the end of the day, and it kind of like starts during midday and then kind of drifts
right.
into, drifts into evening throughout the rest of the film, but it has kind of this orange, this sunset-y feel. But yeah, as far as your question on camera, we were going to shoot it on like the RE35,
mm-hmm.
but then Gareth Edwards had just shot, I'm going to get the film wrong, The Creator on FX3,
mm-hmm.
Which is for people that don't know cameras, it's a prosumer camera, you know, the size of like a small paperback book kind of thing, you know, like a Nintendo Switch almost. And he was like, well, if Gareth Edwards can shoot a, you know, $20 million film on a $3,000 camera, so can we.
Yep.
So we ended up shooting on the FX3 with, and we got two of them. So it's actually not a single camera production.
Wow, that's great.
It's a camera. Yeah, so we were getting coverage. We would get our shot reverse shots at the same time. And so our actors could really play off of each other, knowing that like they were in close up.
Yeah.
So instead of just giving a line reading when they're off camera and then having to get into character and give the performance a second time when camera was on them, both people could be in the scene and really be in the scene at the same time, because both of them mm-hmm. were like in their close up. And it also saved us a lot of time. I mean, it was difficult at some points because of the angles and like not sure. getting in each other's shot. But actually, I mean, yeah, I think it was a great boon to us to have, and it saved us a lot of time. We made all of our days with like time to spare, which gave us time to then play with performance.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a scene with Lee where he's in the house with Nathan and they're having an argument, you know, and he's like, well, you know, it's not like I was robbing the general store. And at first we had him delivering that kind of sallow, like he was in trouble and you know, kind of shy. And then we got through that scene and we had extra time because we had shot reverse shot. And Broderick was like, can I do one where I just lose it? I think that feels more like Lee. And I was like, yeah, let's try it. If you're feeling it, we got time, you know, let's explore. And so that was really awesome to like have that freedom to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In the forest, it's all handheld. Yeah, it was all,
yeah.
It's all handheld. So we were just like, we're either going to be on sticks or we're going to handhold it. And, you know, we had the easy rigs to help us like steady cam it, but we didn't have like a full steady cam rig because we just couldn't get it around in the forest. And luckily those cameras are light enough that you don't get a lot of bounce.
Mm-hmm.
So we could get away with some handheld stuff and it still looked decently smooth. And then afterwards, which I really love, because what we wanted to do originally was shoot it on 16mm, and we just couldn't make it happen with all of the logistics. We were mm-hmm. like, by the time we couldn't shoot two cameras 16mm at the same time.
No way.
So, yeah, right? Yeah, no way.
Not on your budget, so, no.
Not on our budget, not even close. But what we did at the end of the film is we added a 16mm emulator. Do you know anything about these at all?
I have heard a little bit about them, but it totally transforms it so it looks 16mm.
Yeah, and people are like, oh, it's like a filter, and it's like, it's so much more than a
yeah,
filter.
Yeah, it's not a filter. It actually is no. altering, it's essentially altering the grain, the pixels, within what you've just shot, or what you're shooting.
Yeah. So it adds that grain and it adds that halation and that softness, mm-hmm. you know, just that little kiss of softness that you get in film.
Right.
It's not, it's more warm rather than so precisely crisp. So our colorist, Pierre Habib, he went through and he did like a 500T pass and a 35 millimeter pass. And like we sat down and we gave it this 16 millimeter look. Mm-hmm. And I think it just brings the film to life. And so now you can get filmic look for people that can't afford film, and you can still get that body.
Yeah.
Which I think is super special, you know? So like when people are like, oh, did you shoot it on 16 mil? And I'm like, it's 16 mil, but it's a digital output. You know, it's kind of how, you know, we were like, what's the difference between, because people, you know, people do a digital scan to 16 mil. And it's like, well, what's the difference between a digital scan to 16 mil and then a digital reproduction? And there's a lot of arguments that I'm probably starting right now with people. and I love film. I love it. But, you know, for us, that was a way for us to get that 16 mil feel in our budget, and I really think it sells it. I mean, I just really love the look of it. And that was all thanks to Steve and to Pierre.
What lenses were you shooting with your FX3?
Yeah, we were using Cook Primes.
My favorites. I love Cook Primes.
Yeah. Got a Cook fan. All right. Yeah. And of course, you know, the glass really makes it.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So, you know, throw some Cooks on FX3 and you're cooking.
Yeah. I'll tell you. Mark Pellington has always sworn. He says, I don't care about the camera. It's not about the camera. It's the glass. All that matters is the glass. And it shows in
They're shooting films on cell phones now, you know what I mean? Like, say what you will about that, but, you know, like, I went and saw Unsane? Is that
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I think it's, and, you know, it's great. It's a blast. And you can tell it was filmed on an iPhone, but, like, the story is still really good. It's a film.
Now, what was the editing process like on this one? You're working with Seth Sherman. But I'm curious about the editing because you have to ratchet up tension. You have to have an ebb and flow to bring us back down, to diffuse the situation that is growing exponentially worse. So how challenging was the editing here?
That's a fantastic question. I love this question. I haven't gotten this yet. So the way that we do the edit is, while we're filming, and I did this on my last film too, Confinement, if anybody wants to go check that out. But we film our dailies, and then we send our dailies off to Seth and our assistant editor, Bailey, the day we finish. So, like, on July 1st, we send off the dailies to them, and they start assembling them July 2nd. And mm-hmm. we do that the entire film. And so, literally, when we wrapped production on July 30th, 5 days later, Seth had an assembly cut done.
Wow.
So, it's like, you don't have to wait a month to get into the editing room mm-hmm. and be like, I don't remember that take. I don't remember. It's all still fresh in your brain.
Right.
Because they put it together right then. So, I mean, it just feels like cheating, you know? It's like you get done with the film, and then the film's ready for you. So that's how we did our first assembly cut. The thing that I love about working with Seth is that his cuts are, like, almost, I would say, like, 90% of the time are, like, the cut that I would make. I'll be sitting there, and we'd be watching it, and we'd come around the corner, and I'd be like, now, at this point, what I want to do is I want to do an L cut right, and then it happens. And I'm like, oh, what? And he was like, oh, I had the same idea. I had the same thought. But he works out of Los Angeles, and I flew into L.A., and I spent a month with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just in the editing suite for a month straight, I think every day except for maybe weekends. I'm getting off track. The point is, we just sat in the editing suite for a month, and like cut it down. So originally the film was 2 hours and 30 minutes with our assembly edit.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to take 30 minutes out of the film mm-hmm. to get it to where it is now. And I think that was the toughest part, you know, because there were some, oh man, we shot this scene that had a train in it, and we had like figured out the logistics with an actual train to be in the background of, I know, I can't believe it. And we cut it. It's not in the film.
Oh God.
I know. It was just like, do we need this scene? And I was like, don't say that, Seth. And he's like, but do we need it to tell the story? And I'm like, don't say that, Seth. And he's like, I don't think we need it. And so we trimmed it down. But yeah, to your point, it's the ebb and flow of kind of like the tension and release was one of the biggest parts that we were editing for. Like, there's, again, without giving away, I'll be vague.
So be very vague.
There's a couple, yeah, there's a couple left turns in the film. And, you know, setting those scenes up and then delivering them, like, afterwards, kind of, like, getting that timeline to flow correctly was really tricky, especially when we had kind of removed certain scenes. It was like, oh, well, we're supposed to go into this scene next. And it's like, well, but for time, we need to lose that scene. And so making it mesh and, like, yeah, like, kind of, like, feel like there's this growing tension, and then having these things occur, that was the trickiest part. But I think the thing that I'm really proud of is, like, by the time you get to the third act, the film is just running, at least in my opinion. And, like, from the break into three all the way to the end of the film, it's just like, oh, man. What is going to happen?
Yeah, the third act is nonstop. It's nonstop, that third act, Dylan. And you are on the edge of your seat because this is a tinderbox that is now, you feel it's going to explode.
And setting that up was the hardest part. That was like what we, you know, getting all of them, the pieces to fall in line for that. And that's what we were hoping for. And I even had some friends come up to me afterwards. I mean, not even, and, you know, strangers too, you know, they were like, oh man, I was just watching the movie and I was thinking to myself, what's going to happen? Oh man. That's just the biggest compliment to get, you know, that was just a huge compliment. So thanks to everybody that said that.
But that was one of the key things in the first two acts of the film, two thirds of the film. It was so important for you to give us some breathing room and for us to feel the ebb where tensions, Webb tried diffusing them a little bit. We had a chance to breathe, and then you build it back up again before it's just a continuous building to the crescendo. But we needed those calmer moments to show cooler heads might prevail, so that you would get the impact that you have with that third act. So very well done with that
edit.
Thank you so much. With that pacing and developing that. Because that's a tricky thing to do, especially in a film like this. Makes it even harder.
Yeah. No, Seth crushed it. And, you know, all the pieces come together, right? You know, I mean, I feel like cinema is just one of the hardest art forms to master because it's all of the art forms. You know, you need a great actor, you need a great editor, you need a great cinematographer. Like, all these different specialties have to come together. But we wanted that time, kind of like to your point, we wanted that, those, like, lows, we had to bring it back down to show the humanity of Daniel, so that you could connect in order to... I'm the guy, I want to leave it vague. In order to understand the journey. If we had just blown it out, then you'd be like, oh, well, I'm checked out on this character. You know, like, there's nothing to save here.
Right.
But with those low moments, you can kind of be like you said, it's like, oh, like, what's going to happen? Are calmer heads going to prevail or not?
Yeah. Now, there's another element of this film that you did not forget about, and that is your score, Anthony Sabatino's score. What were you looking for musically to support and add to the storytelling of the militia? because you could have gone in multiple directions musically because of the very nature of the subject matter. So I'm curious what you were looking for and what your conversations were like with Anthony to come up with the score that he has developed for you.
No, we talked about it a lot, and Anthony is crazy. Like, it's, you will give him the worst, I will give him the worst descriptions. I mean, not, I'm trying my hardest, but sometimes I'll be like, can you, like, what if it was more like a tree? And he'll be like, oh, you mean like this? And then he'll just play some beautiful, evocative theme that for somehow you're like, that does sound like a tree. I didn't know that a tree could sound like something, but that is the music that I would associate with a tree. You know, like, he thinks in sound, you know? It's just magic to watch him work. I, like, half the time I just laugh when I'm sitting down in his studio because I'm just like, I don't know how you're doing this. It's amazing. But we wanted something militaristic.
Mm-hmm.
But we also wanted something ominous. And then what I kind of told him is that I, again, with like the sunset of childhood, of adolescence, I wanted this somber tone. And so those were kind of like the three big notes that we started with. But then we broke it down into like a bunch of different, you know, he would make a lot of different cues. And then we would sit down and we would listen to each cue and be like, okay, you know, I'm liking the guitar here, but then it gets a little too Western-y. Mm-hmm. So like at first we kind of like went towards the Western route. Like there was a couple of like, wow, like, and it was like, no, that's not it. That's too
right.
Hard. And so we would reel it back in. And then, you know, we kind of like referenced a few different things. I referenced like Flags of Our Fathers, Letters to Iwo Jima was another one mm-hmm. that we kind of like discussed. But then when we would talk about it, and Anthony was like adamant about this, he's like, I don't want to replicate another score. Like, I won't do that. Like, I can try and get the feel from what you're talking about, but like, I'm not going to replicate another score. I you know, it has to be original, which is awesome. And so we would sit down, we would like listen to the cues. But then once we got down the main theme first,
uh-huh.
Which is Daniel's theme. It's that guitar riff.
Yeah.
And actually, oh, that's right. This story's so cool. The guitar riff that is Daniel's theme came from Michael Broderick. Michael Broderick used to be in a band. He is a phenomenal guitar player. One of his requests on set, he was like, I don't want much. I don't need anything special, you know. Just get me on set and I'll be happy. But I would love to have a guitar. If you can get me a guitar so I can play guitar when I'm on my downtime, that would be greatly appreciated. So we got him a guitar. And then he's like, man, it'd be so cool if I could play guitar on screen.
I was just thinking.
And I was like, that's a great idea. Like, I can see Lee as a guitar player.
Yeah.
And then he was like, well, let me think of some, like... And so that song that he plays, When the Stage Goes Dark, was a song that he had co-written with another friend of his. And he kind of adjusted it for the film. And he's like, he played it for me. And I was like, can you like play it in a minor key? And he's like, oh, interesting. And so he wrote it into a minor key. And then that's what you hear when he's playing in his bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
That's Michael playing.
Wow.
And, you know, it starts as diegetic sound, right? Like mm-hmm. sound that's actually being played, and then it turns into the score as we progress. And so Anthony took pieces of that, then the cues that he created, then the notes from me, and then we sat down and we watched the entire film, and Anthony scores it live. So he watches the film and he plays to the performance.
Wow.
So there's a couple times where like the piano will go like ding on a blink, and he's like, I had to put the G on her blink because it adds that emphasis on her performance. So yeah, Anthony's crazy. It's great.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was so fun. It was so cool. It was such a great process. Like, I can't recommend him enough. If anybody's looking for someone, call Anthony Sabatino. I mean, yeah, it's really fun to work with him.
So now that you've had your world premiere and the militia is out there in the world, as you sit back, having survived Dances with Films and the festival experience and all, and gotten audience feedback, what did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker that you can now take forward into your future productions?
That is a great question. That's a tough question too. Okay, so we were having when we were doing some test screenings, we were having a problem with people judging the film, judging a book by its cover. So they would see the poster or they would watch the trailer, and it was hard to make the trailer show what the film is about without giving away like the ending. And we've had some people be like, well, how can you make a right-wing propaganda puff piece like this? And it's like, well, that's not what the film's about at all. Like, you gotta, it's like, did you watch it? And they're like, oh, no, I didn't watch it. I just saw that it had guns on the poster. And it's just like, well, watch them. You gotta watch it. You gotta watch the film to understand the message. You can't judge a book by its cover. And we started to second guess the film. I was just like, did I make a mistake? Like, is this, maybe I should not have made this film. Same thing I said before in a different thing was kind of, it's a Scorsese quote where he says, you have to be obsessed with your film, otherwise you're doing the wrong thing. And I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with this storyline. I was obsessed with the culture. I was obsessed with the extremism that's happening in the country. And I was upset about it, and I wanted to make a movie that addressed it, to be like, how do you get here? How do you go so wrong? And so I felt really strongly about the film, but then when the response came, I was just like feeling pretty sad, and was just like, maybe I made a mistake. Again, it was Ross, my sound operator, that was like, dude, like, don't ever be sorry for like your art. What other people take away from it, that's them. That's their opinion. But he said, kind of said this quote, which you might know, where it's like, other people's opinions of you are none of your business. Have you heard this quote?
I've heard that quote.
So I had to kind of accept that the film's controversial and let go, and just believe in my message, and that if somebody comes up to me and says, like, why would you make a film like this? And be like, look, I don't condone violence. Like, I don't condone what the militia in this film does. I think what they do is totally wrong. But to explore it is, I think important. Otherwise, if we don't ask questions, we're going to make the same mistakes. But it was tough for me to get there, because when people were like, I don't like it, that was hard to hear. So I think the lesson that I've learned, is like, stay true to yourself, which a lot of people say, but I had to learn it the hard way. I definitely was having some doubts at first, and was kind of like, oh, maybe I made a mistake. But in the end, kind of came out the other side of it, where it's like, no, it's like, it's not a mistake. And especially if people take their time to absorb and discuss, like, really, really appreciate the art, then there's a conversation to be had there. So yeah, it was the, like Ross said, it's like, don't be sorry, like, make your art.
So now, have you gotten any bites on distribution? What's next for the militia?
Yeah, we have. We've got we were we came out of the we came out of the theater, and there's a line of people that wanted to say hello and talk to us after the film. And it was kind of funny. One one person came up to me and went, oh, hey, you know, I'd love to film. I'm actually a distributor, and I'd love to start a conversation with you about, you know, selling the film. And I went, oh, great, thanks. You know, got their information. And then the next person goes, oh, that's so funny that that guy was a distributor. I'm also a distributor, and I'd like to start a conversation if that's okay. You know, like, would you mind if I gave you everything? It's like, great. And then the third person came up and they went, well, guess what I am? I was like, are you a distributor? And they went, yep. I've gotten a handful of bites, a full hand. So we're starting conversations. We're looking at, you know, what that's like. And I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch, but yeah, I think it should be available this winter for people to view out in the world.
That would be incredible. Now, are you working on any other film, a new film right now, or are you just going to ride this out, worry about getting a distribution deal for Militia? Where are you in that scheme? You got to make more movies, Dylan.
We've got to make more movies. That's the plan. We're in pre-production right now for my next feature. It's called Sacred Wasteland. In talks with Sam Williamson to star in it again, to work with him a second time. And it's about a young man whose mother has just died of cancer. And he runs away from home. And meets an older lady that lives in an RV, and they go on a road trip together, and he's kind of trying to cure his grief through kind of the surrogate mother, and it's an interesting film.
The fact that you're saying RV and road trip, is it your intention to actually take this RV on a road trip?
I think that Ross is very upset with me again because of Luke. But I think it's going to be an actual road trip, yeah.
Why? The minute you said RV and road trip, it's like, I just knew it. Dylan is going to drag everybody out on the road in an RV and film in an RV on the road.
We got to live our truth.
Oh, my God. So are you going to have Steven back as your DP?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I've been working with Steve for almost a decade now, and we just work so well together. I love working with Steve.
But you're getting to the point with these films and the logistics of them. He may finally have enough and say, Dylan, no, you're on your own.
I hope not. I think he's a... We'll see if he's excited about the road trip scenario, but I think there's also some, you know, chances to get some really amazing shots when you get out on the road and do stuff too. So that's what I'll pitch to him, right? I'll be like, look at your opportunity to make some really great art.
That's it. You can get different light filtration because of the sun's positioning, bouncing off of the mountains in Utah or the Grand Canyon or dirty lakes and ponds we find. Oh, yeah. You got big visual selling points here that you're going to have to play up, Dylan.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've called it. Yeah, we're going to make a couple stops at some national parks. So that'll be pretty exciting, I think.
Well, now, next thing you have to worry about with national parks may be permitting for the national parks.
Absolutely.
And the budgeting for the national parks has just been cut. So
yeah, that's not cool.
So you may find some national parks that you can no longer access.
Don't. I hate that is true. Yeah.
That is just a word to the wise on what, before you start shot blocking and things like that, and you should really figure out where you're going to be able to shoot, what will be accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be like even more logistic than this one, for sure, especially since we're on the road.
Yeah. Just a helpful hint there. That'd be the first thing as a producer that I would be thinking of. It's, oh my God.
I love it. You're already in the producer mind frame. You're like, okay, how are we going to do this?
I'm always in a producer's mind frame, let me tell you. But because you got to think of those things, you got to look at the totality of the circumstances. And right now we're in such flux in terms of locations. And you mentioned national parks, and national parks, you're dealing with the government. Just keep in mind about the budgeting for the national parks as you're plotting out this next film.
Will do.
Dylan, this has been an absolute joy getting to speak with you. I can't wait till you make another film so we can chat again.
Yeah, thank you so much for the interview. Your questions were phenomenal. Yeah, this was a really good time.
Well, thank you. I had a really good time too. So you now go enjoy your holiday weekend.
Yeah, happy 4th of July, and go do it up.
And please, either you or Scott are going to have to let me know when you get that distribution deal.
Yeah, we'll keep you in the loop. Yeah, it should be where conversations are going, so keep your fingers crossed for us.
I definitely will. Thank you again so
Cool.
much, Dylan. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Talk to you later.